Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. This week, we talk about the physics of fire-driven thunderstorms, and we learn what it's like to start a new scientific society. But first, what do Vera Rubin, W. Kent Ford Jr., and Brian Josephson have in common with Isaac Newton, Maria Goeppert-Mayer, and Simeon Denis Poisson? The answer is that they all appear in our list of the 10 greatest predictions in physics, which you can find in the January issue of Physics World magazine and on our website, physicsworld.com. Entries include Albert Einstein's prediction of the perihelion precession of Mercury in 1915, which he made using his newly minted general theory of relativity. And we also mention Tsung Dao Li and Chen Ning Yang's 1957 prediction of parity violation in the weak interaction, which was confirmed experimentally within 1 year. To read about these and other memorable predictions, go to the features section on physicsworld.com and look for the article, The 10 Greatest Predictions in Physics, by David Apple. And we would like to know what you think of our list. I, for one, was surprised that Paul Dirac's prediction of the existence of antimatter didn't make the cut. So please do send us an email. You can find our contact details on physicsworld.com. It's been a year since Australia's black summer fire season, which was a hell on earth when severe wildfires were stoked by record-breaking temperatures and drought. The extreme conditions also triggered fire-driven thunderstorms known as pyrocumulonimbus events. Scientists are only beginning to understand this phenomenon and its implications for the global climate system. To find out more, Physics World's James Dacey caught up with David Peterson, a meteorologist at the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory in Monterey, California.
Okay, Dave, thanks for joining today.
Thanks for having me.
I know you're interested in these really dramatic events known as pyrocumulonimbus, where wildfires on the Earth can trigger thunderstorms and smoke clouds. Can you talk us through the basic principles of these events?
Sure. So a wildfire-driven thunderstorm, we call this pyrocumulonimbus. That's the technical term. The community will refer to these as pyro-CB for short. And as you mentioned, it's the wildfire that actually triggers the thunderstorm. So unlike some of these typical thunderstorm clouds you may see in the distance with lightning and rain, in this case, the thunderstorm is actually being fed by the heat from the wildfire. And so that means the smoke being released by the fire is fed directly into the cloud. And you basically set up this really efficient transport pathway. Think of it as like a giant chimney. Moving smoke from near the surface and injecting it to extremely high altitudes. That's usually the altitude that aircraft typically travel, the cruising altitudes. But sometimes those smoke plumes can reach even higher into the next level of the atmosphere, which is the stratosphere.
And how long have we known about this phenomena?
So it's been known for a long time that wildfires, when they're really intense, can develop clouds on top of the smoke plumes. But the actual pyro-CB phenomenon and the impacts that it can have go back about 20 years, around, say, the year 2000. And that's a time when we got this rapid proliferation in available satellite data. And it's these new observations that came around the turn of the century that allowed us to really explore the phenomenon in more detail.
What was the first known event?
So there were a large number of satellite sensors, mainly launched by NASA and other institutions, that allowed you to track plumes of aerosol particles in the atmosphere much more efficiently than in previous decades. And it was discovered that there were a number of so-called mystery plumes at high altitudes that couldn't be traced back to volcanic eruptions. And in the early 2000s, it was found that some of these mystery plumes actually came from wildfire events in central Canada. And that's how the Pyro CB phenomenon was discovered. And from there, we began to draw similarities between these thunderstorms over wildfires and volcanic eruptions.
So I guess for a lot of people, they may have first heard about this event from the Australian summer of 2019-20, when, you know, several of these huge scale events were triggered around the turn of the year. I mean, what was it that made that particular event so unprecedented?
Right. So the Australian event of a year ago was the largest wildfire-driven thunderstorm event in history. It exceeded almost every level of magnitude. So to put this in some perspective, most of these Pyro CB events feature, say, one, two, maybe the big ones, maybe five or seven different Pyro CB updrafts. In Australia, we had almost 40. And this occurred over multiple days. And so it's many times larger in terms of the number of fires and Pyro CB storms involved. And so that translated to the largest smoke plumes we've ever observed in the lower stratosphere.
And in terms of the, you know, the actual conditions on the ground, I mean, lots was reported at the time about the severity of these fires. But I mean, was there a particular a feature, you know, a certain kind of dryness to them? Or, you know, what was it that actually led to the event being so big?
Right. So Australia was in sort of a perfect storm, if you will, scenario. So they had gone through a period of extreme drought, extremely warm temperatures, which set the stage for these large wildfires. And once the wildfires got going, you know, they persisted for many weeks and months. And we had a period right around New Year's when weather conditions became very favorable for thunderstorm activity over top of these large wildfires. And so I think that's an important point, is that not only did we have these really intense and large wildfires, but we also had an atmospheric condition that was supportive of Pyro CB storms.
So I know in the months that followed, the smoke cloud itself, it went on a bit of a journey. It headed first towards South America and then came back and eventually ended up over South Africa. The whole Pyro CB community had this opportunity to, you know, to track this cloud. And what did you learn about its dynamics and the way that it interacted with weather?
Well, the amount of smoke released into the stratosphere by this event was roughly three times larger than any smoke plume from any previous Pyro CB event. And when you look at this quantitatively, the smoke mass was actually larger than the majority of volcanic plumes observed at the same altitudes over, say, the last 12 years. So this is a smoke plume of volcanic scale. And just like large volcanic eruptions, it actually encircled the entire southern hemisphere. So over the weeks and months following this event, the smoke plume was transported in various different ways. There were large components of it that held together. And then there were areas where the smoke kind of diffused as it spread out. And we found that some of these smoke components actually continued rising with time. The smoke will actually absorb solar radiation, creating a heating effect, and that allows the smoke to keep rising. And at the same time, it was so large that the smoke plume actually induced its own circulation in the stratosphere as it continued rising. And so this is one of our first examples of a Pyro CB smoke plume actually affecting the dynamics of the atmosphere. And that is one of many questions that we're still looking at in terms of the role of Pyro CB in the climate system.
So, I mean, you described the Australia event as a kind of perfect storm, in reference to the fires. But with a changing global climate, I mean, is it expected that we might see more of these events, or perhaps even larger scale events?
Right. So, over the past few years, we've seen large, if not record, fire seasons in many regions worldwide. And many of these regions are areas where we tend to see a lot of Pyro CB activity. So, you know, this Australian event was preceded less than 3 years earlier by another large Pyro CB event in Western Canada. And at the time, that was the event that no one had seen before. You know, that was the unprecedented event, only to be exceeded by the Australian event, which was roughly three times larger. So, you know, this is something that's been increasing in magnitude pretty rapidly, and we're still trying to catch up in terms of the understanding. Now, if you put more wildfires on the landscape, obviously that tends to increase your chance for some of the other effects that go along with wildfire. But as I mentioned earlier, it's important to note that having a wildfire is just the first step. In order to get these really large outbreaks of Piracy B storms, you also have to have an atmosphere that's at least somewhat favorable for thunderstorm development as well.
So, I mean, what is it exactly that causes the thunderstorm? What is the mechanism between, you know, the fire to this smoke cloud to then generating a thunderstorm?
Right. So the wildfires are burning in an environment that's very dry. It's your typical fire weather conditions near the ground, dry, hot, somewhat windy, keeping those fires going. But in order to get the thunderstorm, you also need a moisture source. And so, you know, if that moisture source was near the ground, it wouldn't really support the fire because the fire needs dry conditions. And so what we find is that the moisture source for these storms is actually well above the ground, say 3 to 5 kilometers. And so as that wildfire heating generates the updraft and it rises into that level of atmosphere where you have this moisture source, that uplift will allow condensation to occur. And then that also results in the release of latent heating and other things that allows the cloud to keep developing just like any other thunderstorm. And then in the end, you end up with a very large thunderstorm cloud. But in this case, it's also filled with smoke. And so you can think of Piracy B as some of the dirtiest clouds on Earth.
The biggest volcanic eruption of the past 100 years, I think, in terms of the mass ejected into the stratosphere is Pinatubo in 91. And one of the reported impacts of that was that it cooled the global climate temporarily. I mean, with the really large-scale Pyro-CB effects, do you envisage the same kind of impacts?
Well, I think it's important to note that even though this Australian event produced a smoke plume that was larger than many volcanic eruptions over the past couple of decades, we're still not on the same order of magnitude as Pinatubo. And so that was a much larger event in terms of the amount of aerosol particles injected into the stratosphere. Now, however, the altitude that the Australian smoke plume reached was almost identical to the Pinatubo altitude. We're talking almost 35 kilometers. That's at and above the ozone layer. So, you know, one of the things that's different about Piracy B smoke is it's very efficient. Because it's a smoke, it's carbon-based, it's very efficient at absorbing solar radiation in the stratosphere, and that allows it to continue rising with time. And so that acts to increase the lifetime of the smoke plume. And so, you know, while Pinatubo definitely caused this large global climate shift, the effect of these large and apparently increasingly large Piracy B smoke plumes is still being studied. There are many groups right now, including us, trying to determine if you get these large smoke plumes, and let's say you have more of them in the future, what does that mean for downstream effects? We have to quantify yet just how much cooling might occur at the surface from these smoke plumes. But as I noted earlier, the potential effect on weather must also be identified. Australia showed that the smoke can affect the circulation in the stratosphere. And, you know, some of the things that we're interested in, especially where I work with the Navy, is how can these smoke plumes affect weather down in the troposphere and the level where we work and operate. And so there still remain a lot of questions that we're looking at.
So I mean, have your findings, and I guess the findings of the field in general, have they been incorporated yet into weather modeling and climate modeling?
So there have been a few simulations published of the event in Canada back in 2017. That was the previous unprecedented event. And I know a few groups are currently working on simulating the Australian event. But this Australian event, you know, not only was it many times larger, it was also far more complicated. multiple smoke plumes being released over several days. And so a lot of those efforts are still underway. But one thing that I think is important to point out is there are a variety of aerosol forecasting systems being used in the world today. The Navy has one, NOAA has one, the European forecast centers have their own aerosol model, but none of these include the PyroCB smoke effect. They're all designed based on typical smoke behavior, which is usually near the ground or a few kilometers above. And so we're working very hard to be able to develop prediction capabilities for these PyroCB storms and the ensuing smoke plumes afterward.
Because I know another way of developing our understanding is to actually try and get data during these events. And I think were you involved in a mission in 2019 using NASA's DC-8 aircraft where you actually flew above one of these events while it was happening? I mean, tell us about that experience. You know, it sounds incredible.
That's right. So that was part of a large, probably one of the largest wildfire field experiments ever convened. It was known as Fire XAQ. And we were participating in that as part of the forecasting team. And we were able to identify or forecast for a period when PyroCB development was likely over a wildfire in our study region. And so one of the big things with PyroCB is we have a lot of observations from space, from satellite, but direct measurements from within the outflow region at the top of the cloud are lacking. And you really need those direct in situ measurements to know how the cloud is affecting the smoke and what the chemistry of the smoke is coming out of the top of those clouds. So during FireX, we were able to get NASA's DC-8 aircraft right there at the top of the cloud. It's kind of like a really well-organized storm chase with an aircraft, if you will. So we're putting this aircraft, which is basically a laboratory in the air, many different suites of instrumentation related to chemistry, cloud microphysics, and other things that are essential for understanding how PyroCB evolve, especially since they're perturbed with smoke. And so it's a very exciting data set that we look forward to applying in future studies.
So what is this plane that NASA uses, the DC-8 aircraft, what does that actually look like inside? I mean, if most people will only have experience of a passenger aircraft. So, you know, compared with that, how does it differ?
So if anyone's ever flown on a 737 or a 757, you know, it's fairly large passenger aircraft. It's a similar size to this NASA DC-8. It has four engines. So imagine now taking out many rows of seating and replacing that with racks of instrumentation. And these instruments, a lot of them have inlets that go to the outside air and pull that into the aircraft and process it through these instruments to take direct measurements. And that could be gas phase chemistry, so looking at carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, things like that. Could be aerosol phase chemistry, looking at the size distributions of the smoke particles. There's also probes on the wings to look at the actual cloud particles themselves. And on top of that, there's a suite of remote sensing instrumentation where we can get a really detailed look at the fire and as it's actually triggering this cloud. And that's also one of the big unknowns is just what are the fire characteristics you need to start this PyroCB development process. And so we hope to learn a lot with all of these different types of observations.
So from that particular mission, I mean, have you published any findings? You know, what have been the key discoveries so far based on that data?
So we're still working towards a publication. We've spent the last year or so sorting through these data to see what we have. And I think one of the early findings we've noted is that at each time when a PyroCB cloud developed, the region of the fire, the flaming region, was very large and deep. It wasn't these really narrow fire fronts. And so you get these larger areas of flaming combustion that create these really concentrated updrafts. And that's really what you need to get the smoke column up high enough into that favorable region of the atmosphere where you have the moisture source needed to start the whole process along. And along with that, we've also been looking at the measurements of the smoke as it was expelled through the top of the cloud at roughly jet aircraft cruising altitudes, and noticed that, you know, the smoke particles and properties do change some as they're processed through the cloud. And that's important for any future modeling efforts to try to determine how these smoke plumes evolve once they reach the stratosphere in other cases.
Are there any other key questions that you'll be tackling in this field personally in your research?
You know, that the Naval Research Lab where I work, along with colleagues at the branch of the lab in Washington, D.C., you know, we've been leading a lot of these efforts with time and have developed some of these initial systems to look at Pyrrhus EB storms. And so it's very exciting now to see the community grow. You know, it's very multidisciplinary. You have chemists, you have remote sensing scientists, you have meteorologists all getting involved now to understand this effort, which really only goes back about 20 years. Mm-hmm. So there's still a lot more we can learn. With our research, we're going to continue diving into that data set obtained during FIRE-XAQ and trying to tell a story of how the Pyrrhus EB phenomenon evolves from the ground and up through the entire lifetime. And we'll be working with those in the modeling community to help improve what we call the initialization of these large smoke plumes based on what we know of the chemistry observed in that particular case and other things. We'll also be working really hard looking in more detail at the conditions that result in Pyrrhus EB development and working with an existing algorithm that we've developed with satellite data to detect Pyrrhus EB storms once they've developed. We hope to build a sort of level before that, a warning capability based on what we know with weather conditions leading up to Pyrrhus EB. Can we provide some advanced warning? And then while the event's ongoing, we can provide the observations that show the effect of it evolving. And then afterwards, with our aerosol models, can we track that event downwind and look at the regions affected?
I mean, how did you yourself, you know, first get involved in this? Because it's obviously, you know, still a fairly recent field. How did you discover it?
So while I was in my college years, my initial degree was in meteorology. So I was very into thunderstorm activity, especially here in the United States. And then as I went into grad school, I got involved with the remote sensing community, looking at satellite data as applied to wildfires. And then over time, once I started working at the Naval Research Lab, you know, that the branch that I work in Monterey, California, we have a large component of people working on remote sensing. We run a global aerosol model, and we're also a meteorology-focused lab. And so the three kind of combined to provide a really ideal study environment for looking at Pyrrhus EB storms.
Okay, Dave. Well, I mean, good luck with developing the work over the coming years. And thanks again for joining today.
Thanks very much for having me.
That was James Dacey in conversation with David Peterson. Some scientific societies like the Institute of Physics have long and distinguished histories. But science is ever-changing, and sometimes the need arises for a new professional organization. Next up, Physics World's Tammy Freeman talks to two researchers who identified such a gap and got involved in setting up a brand new scientific society.
Last year, a group of researchers from across the globe started up a new scientific society, the International Society of Radiation Epidemiology and Dosimetry, or ISORED. I'm speaking today with two of the team involved in this new venture, Amy Berrington, Senior Investigator and Radiation Epidemiology Branch Chief at the National Cancer Institute in the USA. Hi, Amy.
Good morning, Tammy.
And also Suman Sresta, a Doctoral Research Fellow in the Department of Radiation Physics at the MD Anderson Cancer Center. Hi, Suman.
Hello, Dr. Freeman. Thank you for having us.
Amy, You were one of the co-founders of ISO-RED. So what was the reason for setting up this new society? Why was it needed?
So the discussions on it started really a couple of years ago when a group of us at the radiation research meeting started talking about the real need to find a way to help radiation epidemiologists and dosimetrists around the world connect more frequently and in a closer way. So there are several large societies like Radiation Research and AAPM, and thus these are really important for helping everyone interact with the much broader radiation community. But we've always been a bit of a fringe group at those sorts of meetings, and we tend to get lost. So we were really looking for a way to be able to connect our smaller community in a better and closer way. The history of it as well is that we did used to have a biannual meeting that we held that was mostly just radiation epidemiologists and dosimetrists that was supported by the American Statistical Association. And that was stopped now more than 5 years ago because of funding issues. So the idea was that the new society would sort of reinvigorate those meetings as well as having a sort of broader mission.
Okay. And what can you describe the main mission of the society now?
Yeah, sure. So we have three goals in the society. We want to bring together the radiation research community, particularly epidemiologists and dosimetrists, and be able to provide a forum to discuss our new research and also discuss our research methods. We want to support capacity building and mentoring, particularly for the junior investigators in the field. And we also want to provide a way of promoting and facilitating collaboration across the international team of researchers.
Okay, thanks. And Suman, how did you get involved in ISO-RED? And what is your role in the society?
My first involvement in ISO-RED started with abstract submission, actually. Since I'm a doctoral researcher, I submitted an abstract that was accepted to the inaugural scientific meeting in 2020. I actually received a fellowship to attend the conference, which was exciting. Although COVID-19 kind of changed our plans, got introduced to the society in this manner. As doctoral fellows in MD Anderson, we train with exceptional scientists on research, but the goal is to develop future leaders in the field. Since the entire scientific establishment moves forward with lots of volunteer efforts from peer review to serving on different committees and boards, most of our faculty devote some of their time to different committees in leading organizations. And as trainees, we're also encouraged to get involved. I have had a few years of experience serving on committees of other organizations, some as junior member, some at the leadership level. When I realized that goals of ISO-RED as an organization kind of aligns with my own goals, I volunteered. I actually reached out to Dr. Barrington for that. As it happens in most cases, I started as a junior member of the working group, then became the vice chair, and now I serve as the chair of Working Group on Communications. Each working group is composed of scientists at different stages of their career, from early career investigators to well-established scientists and professors. These scientists are from different fields and from all over the world. Although there is some form of hierarchy, it's a team effort. I get help and guidance from the leadership as well as all the members in my group. Especially, I have to thank Dr. Rania Kosti, the coordinator, and Dr. Elisa Pascal, the vice chair of our group, for their help. My working group, the Working Group on Communication, is basically the bridge between scientific community, general public, and the society. We're responsible for all the communication aspects from website, email, social media, online and offline presence. Everything that you see about ISO-RED out there goes through our working group.
Okay, that's great. And then I gather that there's various working groups within the society. Can you tell me about some of the other groups and what they're focusing on?
Sure. There are 8 active working groups in ISO-RED right now with their respective focus and goals. The goals range from supporting early career trainees, assessing scientific documents and scientific abstracts, holding webinars, to environmental sustainability. Among them, early investigator support working group and webinar series working groups have done some excellent work recently. They have successfully launched their global mentorship and webinar initiatives in the past few months, and they're doing really, really well.
So you've just said ICERED's recently launched this worldwide mentorship initiative. How does this work?
So this is the mentoring initiative known as MINI. It's been modeled on successful programs from other big societies like the AAPM. And the goal of it is to expand professional development and career guidance for trainees by pairing them with more senior scientists at other institutions around the world. We started by asking, first of all, mentors who are interested in serving in this capacity to submit applications. We had more than 20 applicants from people interested in serving as mentors. And then we've now opened up to the mentees, and we had nearly 30 applicants from mentees from all around the world, which was really exciting. And we thought an amazing response for our first round. The idea with the program is that the pairs will be expected to meet regularly by phone or Zoom or however they prefer it, eventually, hopefully in person, and discuss activities like how can the mentee be helped with their networking, how can they help with their building connections in the community, and more general career guidance from the mentor.
I'm a student from Nepal, one of the developing countries in South Asia. So I had to work really hard and long to find the right people. And once I did, my career trajectory kind of changed. I had support and guidance from many amazing mentors in my short academic career. So I know the importance of mentorship and how many trainees around the globe are lacking this one ingredient. ICERED Mini Initiative provides this opportunity to individuals who may never have it. And like Dr. Barrington said, we are very excited with the participation on both mentor and mentee side. And we're currently working on matching mentor and mentee pairs and looking forward to what future holds for these trainees. As a trainee from a developing country, I'm very excited about this particular initiative.
Yes, I mean, it does sound like an excellent initiative. I'll be interested to see how that pans out. And then the other thing you mentioned was that this year, instead of having a scientific meeting, which obviously difficult at the moment, ICERED is going to be launching a webinar series. So could one of you tell me a bit more about this?
Yeah, sure. So the webinars have also been designed to closely mirror the overall mission of the society. So it isn't going to be just, you know, one speaker, one senior scientist giving a lecture. It's got quite a different format. So each one is actually going to feature a specific institute, particularly ones that are engaged in training the junior scientists. And we'll start with a short presentation on the research and staff and the training environment of that institute. Then we're going to have a series of short talks by both junior and senior researchers. Again, the idea of providing these sorts of opportunities, particularly for the more junior researchers to be able to communicate their science and connect with the broader community. So I think the idea of pairing the junior and senior researchers together is to help attract a broader audience and give that opportunity to the junior researchers.
So what's the first webinar about, and when is it being held?
The first webinar is 26th of January at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And this one is going to be hosted by my branch, Radiation Epidemiology at NCI. So I'll start by talking a bit about our branch. And then we have three speakers from our Chernobyl research program. So this year is the 35th anniversary of the accident. We have a postdoc talking about machine learning methods to estimate doses to the cleanup workers in the Ukraine. We've got new results on thyroid cancer from the first large-scale tumor sequencing study. of thyroid tumors, and then also some hot off the press results from a large study of thyroid cancer in these same Ukrainian cleanup workers.
Okay, so that's the 26th, that's next Tuesday. So how can listeners sign up to attend this webinar?
So if you go to the ISORED website, there is a link on the website where you can register. Registration is obviously free. You then will just get sent the WebEx link for the meeting.
Like Dr. Barrington said, most direct method would be to go to isored.org and click on the news tab and then click on the webinar announcement. If anyone just searches online for ISORED webinar series, multiple different results will appear on your search bar. Regardless of what you click on, website, Twitter, LinkedIn, ResearchGate, it will have enough information for you to get to the sign up link.
Great. And how can researchers get involved in ISORED if they're interested?
So this is a new society, and as Suman said earlier, there's lots of opportunities, lots of working groups, and we're really dependent on energetic volunteers like Suman who want to help us to succeed. So if people want to volunteer, they can either email me directly or also send an email to the ISORED Society email address. Those messages come directly to myself and also Elizabeth Cardis in Barcelona, and we can direct you to the appropriate working group that you're interested in.
Like Dr. Barrington said, we're always looking for researchers who are willing to contribute to the initiative of the society. If someone is interested, they can reach out through the social media or go to the website and then click on the news tab. Every initiative is under a certain working group, and you'll find a contact within that announcement. Obviously, you can message me, Dr. Kosti, Dr. Pascal, or just send an email to the organization email ID. We will respond, and we'll try and match you to the right working group or right initiative that you're interested in.
Great. Well, thanks very much. Thank you, Amy and Suman, for talking with me today. Thanks both for your time.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank you very much, Tammy.
That was Amy Barrington and Suman Shrestha in conversation with Tammy Freeman. And now it's time for my top tip for a good read on the Physics World website this week. We do love perovskites here at Physics World because it seems like there's nothing that these crystalline materials can't do. Now, John Labrum at Oregon State University in the U.S. and colleagues have created a perovskite-based optical sensor that behaves much like the human eye, in the sense that it's very good at detecting changes in the level of light. The team then did computer simulations that suggest that an array of these devices would be very good at detecting the motions of objects in a scene, such as the flight of a bird. And again, this mimics the ability of our eyes to track moving objects very well. Labrum and colleagues are now trying to scale up the sensors to build arrays. And you can read more about this on the Physics World website. Just look for the headline, Perovskite Sensor Sees More Like the Human Eye. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to David Peterson, Amy Barrington, Suman Shrestha, James Dacey, and Tammy Freeman for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. We'll be back next week, but in the meantime, please check out the latest episode of our sister podcast. It's called Physics World Stories, and the latest episode has some great recommendations of books inspired by physics. Physics World.